Hello and welcome to this Thursday's Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And today we're going to explore a couple of different topics going from the garden to the rain that replenishes the plants in the garden. And first we're going to start out with Jess Oldham. She's the garden manager for the Moab Youth Garden Project, and she's on the line with us from Moab. Thank you for joining me this morning, Jess.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Well, I was just kind of doing some searching around the internet. Plus, I have someone who lives around the corner from me that is very familiar with your project, and that's your brother. And he's the one that said, hey, you need to call and talk to my sister. So that's what we're doing. And tell me about the Youth Garden Project in Moab.
Yeah, so we're a small nonprofit here in Moab. We were started a while ago. We were started in 1996. A local woman saw a need in the community for an educational and nurturing environment for youth, mostly to work off court-ordered community service hours. So she created the Youth Garden Project, and it was run in her backyard. It's just a small organization. And since then, we've grown. We're now on school district property. We are on about an acre and a half of space, and we provide a variety of youth and community programs. We have a beautiful space here. It's right in town, right along the bike path, very visible. And we have about 60 garden rows, a little orchard, a beautiful straw bale greenhouse, and a grow dome. And we've remodeled one of the oldest homes in Moab as our office, and then we've since also built a commercial kitchen where we can preserve our produce on site.
So it sounds to me like you've got a fairly large location. How much land are you sitting on?
We are on an acre and a half. That includes all of our structures as well.
And so talk about the typical day. So during the school year, how do things work out? What are your projects like?
Yeah, so right now we're offering a couple of programs for youth. We kind of have a few separate programs. So right now we have our garden classroom program, and youth, mostly kindergarten through sixth graders, come here with their classes during the day on a field trip, and they come and learn science concepts in the garden. And they come twice a year in the spring and the fall. And then so we have people here running the garden, youth in and out. We also offer an after-school program, so they'll be here. It's a more relaxed program, just kind of interacting with the plants in the garden and also learning about the process of bringing food from seed to table.
I know probably for a lot of them it's a journey of discovery. I was reading on your website about how you were having them looking for insects. This is in one of the blogs, and they found this gigantic beetle, and how exciting that was for them.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing to see that discovery, and you know, there's usually a moment where something just clicks. The other day we had a middle school class here in the afternoon, and they harvested spinach, and for a lot of them that was the first time that they had been cutting something off directly off of the plant, munching on it while they're cutting it. And that was a really awesome moment to see in their eyes, in some of their eyes. And the next day we took that spinach over to the high school, and it was put in the high school's salad bar. So they had that connection. And then earlier in the day, the kindergartners were here, and they tasted a leaf of spinach. And I heard one of the kindergartens yell, "That tastes better than ice cream." So it was a really, all of those moments with one crop was a really interesting way that I saw that youth were discovering the importance of, you know, being connected to the food that they eat.
Well, and how fun for you as well, because you get to see that discovery. See, from my point of view, I've been growing a garden since I was three, so it's hard for me to think that people just don't, especially in Moab. I'm like, okay, well, that's fairly rural. Everybody grows a garden, but that's not the case. I mean, you've got kids that are coming in that they've never seen that before.
Yeah, it's true. It's a really rewarding experience to be part of.
Well, and you also serve the community. I noticed that you are with the farmers market. You have a CSA, and then tell me about this program called Weed and Feed.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite things that we do. So during the season, every other Wednesday evening, We invite community members to the garden, and they'll come and weed for an hour and a half. And we get anywhere from 20 to 50 people who come and weed, and we can get some big projects done with that many hands. So they weed, help us out, and then we all sit down together for a dinner made largely with the produce that we grow here. So it's a really great opportunity to meet people. We get a lot of seasonal employees here in Moab, so it's a good way for long-term community members and short-term community members to meet and interact, and then also benefit from the things that they're helping with.
Well, I've noticed that you must have a lot of volunteers that are working for you because of all of the different projects that you have going.
Yeah, we do.
How does someone volunteer for you? How do they get a hold of you?
We have a number of different ways. You know, we encourage large groups, so we get a lot of people passing through Moab with different organizations or groups that are here to recreate and want to help out the community a little bit. And then we also have people just passing through who will come stop by when they're walking their kids along the bike path and ask if we need help. And we just ask that you contact us and make sure that we're here, and we'll take help whenever we can get it.
Tell me, if you could, a story of someone that you've seen that has been helped or touched through the project.
Yeah, one of my favorite volunteers that we've had here came over from the high school. His name was Derek, and he found this incredible bond with the youth garden, and I think that he was really looking for some social connections and also some things to get really excited about and some projects to take on of his own. And he started coming as part of his class with the high school and ended up coming every day. And he found this special bond with the chickens, and he would come over. The first thing he would do every day is walk over to those chickens, say hello, make sure they're all here. And one day he came over and, we normally had 5 chickens and there were only 4. And his level of concern was really amazing to watch. It was as if a parent had misplaced their child. And so he spent his day here volunteering to find this chicken, and he was able to find little Elvis and had a really special experience that day. And to see the way that his face lit up just by something simple as, just being involved in our space, not even directly with the food that we grow or something, was really incredible. And I hope that helped him. And he's not a volunteer here anymore, but he definitely comes by and checks in and has a special place in his heart for this place.
Well, I look forward to stopping by and visiting the gardens on my next visit to Moab. It looks like an incredible project, and I congratulate you on everything that you're doing with the community and with the youth.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. We were talking with Jess Oldham, garden manager for the Youth Garden Project in Moab. If you'd like more information on the project, you can go to our website, upr.org, and click on the programs link for Zesty Garden, and you'll see a link to the Youth Garden Project in Moab. Again, thank you very much for joining me, Jess. And welcome back. Right now, we're going to move in to a different topic. And if any of you have ever had a rain gauge in your backyard, you know the fun that it can be of going out and seeing how much precipitation you got when a thunderstorm passes through, or talking to your neighbor to see if you got more than your neighbor did. Well, there's a program that needs your help. It's called the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network, or CoCoRoS. It's throughout the country. And the information is collected and used for scientific purposes. And I have on the line from Colorado, Nolan Duskin, who's the state climatologist for Colorado. Nolan, thanks for joining me on the Zesty Garden today.
My pleasure.
Tell me about CoCoRoS.
What do you want to know?
How much time have we got? Now, I've discovered it about, 2 years ago. Working here at Utah Public Radio, I was talking with one of the climatologists about the program. I'm like, this sounds like fun. So I went and got me a gauge, and it has been fun. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, it dates back a number of years. We started it locally here in Fort Collins, Colorado, where I live and work. We had a very catastrophic localized flash flood in the summer of 1997, of which just in our own community, rainfall varied from a remarkable 14 inches plus on one part of town, on the upwind side of the Colorado State University campus, and as little as 2 inches or less on the east side of town, downwind, downwater of the downhill from the heavy rains, and the flash flood that erupted crossed the entire community. We had multiple fatalities and huge amounts of damage, including a lot to our campus. But we had very little information about how much rain actually fell that caused that flood until we did a post-storm assessment, almost going door to door, trying to find people who might have had a rain gauge. And making a long story short, after that event, we were able to piece together a rainfall map many weeks, months later. But people said, what can we do to help? Could we have a rain gauge? And Internet technology was just becoming sort of householdish by that time. It was still a limiting factor, but we literally found a few dozen community members willing to put out a rain gauge, and we got an internet connection set up, used some high school students early on to develop a local project. One student developed the web page, developed mapping and data analysis methodologies, and another student did outreach efforts to try to engage community members in participation. And within a few months, we had a community project going, and we had no idea that it was going to take off to become a nationwide project. It would have been the farthest thing from my dreams as we plugged it in for the first time in 1998. But now we have approaching 20,000 active volunteers and another 20,000 that have at least signed up and given it a try for a little while. And we're literally able to paint a picture every single day of how much rain is falling in different parts of the country and tracking storms across the country. And Utah joined, I'm forgetting now, 5 years ago, something like that. And, of course, we're limited to where people live and are willing and interested to participate. So Utah is like Colorado in that the majority of the population lives in certain corridors. But nevertheless, when we're able to see precipitation and how much it varies over such short distances, it's just incredible to watch.
So I would imagine then that even though you want more volunteers wherever they live, you're especially looking for areas that are underserved. I know in Utah, I was told that there is a Water Rangers, they call the program here, in every single county, but some counties only have one. And so if your county happens to be really big, well, you don't get to see the full picture of a storm that comes through an area.
That's true. But even in the populated counties, just getting as many volunteers as possible, we have a lot in the Salt Lake City area, for example, but if we had three times as many, it would just be three times more interesting watching the patterns as they emerge. With the topography, with the localized nature of both the upslope snow events and the convective storms of spring and summer, the more participants, the merrier. Yes, we really need folks in the low population rural areas to get a better picture, but any place where we find interested people who can put out a rain gauge and get involved, it's better for us and better for those who use the data.
So literally just about anyone can participate. You don't have to have any special qualifications to start reporting.
The only qualifications are a mild interest in keeping track of precipitation. It does take a little bit of diligence to want to go out and check that gauge each day, although it's very exciting when it actually does rain or snow. And then you do have to live in a place where you have a reasonable place to place a rain gauge outdoors, that it won't be blocked right by buildings that are overhanging or trees. It doesn't have to be a wide open farmstead sort of a environment. Having trees very nearby are okay as long as you have a clearing directly overhead.
So how much distance should your gauge be from a tree or a building?
Ideally, if the tree is 30 feet tall, you'd like to be able to get 30 feet away from it. And in more open areas, you'd like to get more like 60 feet away from it. Our rule of thumb is in more open areas, get twice as far away from an object as it is high. But as you get into more congested urban areas, getting as far away from an object as it is high is a good rule of thumb. But even then, when you're in the more urbanized or more heavily vegetated areas, the wind is less of a problem because the vegetation and structures are already slowing down the wind. So as long as you have somewhat of a clearing overhead, you're going to get a realistic reading most of the time, maybe not all the time.
So I'm imagining in a more urban setting, maybe on a fence. I've got mine on a fence post, and I've got it placed so that it's sticking up above the fence because I don't want any splash coming in from the fence itself, but it's just sitting a couple inches above that fence post.
That should do the job just fine. That's a good exposure.
So let's talk about the gauge itself. What does it look like, and how does it measure?
Well, that's one thing we've gone to great lengths is to encourage everyone to use the very same rain gauge. And we use one that's essentially a scale model, a smaller version of the historic National Weather Service standard rain gauge. That standard rain gauge was 8 inches in diameter and a little over 2 feet tall, and could withstand about anything that nature threw at it. The gauge we use, again, a scale model of that, about exactly 4 inches in diameter and about 12 inches tall. It will hold, I can't remember what the heaviest rain in Utah history is. It's something like 8 to 11 inches, and this rain gauge will hold that all in its outer cylinder, so that even the heaviest rain that Utah has ever experienced should be contained. It's a clear plastic gauge, so you can look right through it and see the amount of precipitation that's accumulating, and you can take the inner tube and funnel out in the winter, so you can also collect snow. It's viewed by the National Weather Service as equivalent in accuracy to their standardized rain gauge, and as a result, the data are integrated into National Weather Service products and services, which is really pretty neat.
And there, to purchase a gauge, I have a link on the UPR website, so it's upr.org. Click on programs and you'll see Zesty Garden, and there's a link to the Coco Ross website, as well as to the Utah Climate Center, so you can look there, see information, and find out how to purchase a gauge. They even tell you that they'll ship it to you for free. You just have to pay for the gauge, so you can't get any better than that.
That's great.
Now tell me about the type of volunteers that you typically see. Is there a profile that you can give me, or is it just all over the spectrum?
Well, it is all over the spectrum. We have kids as young as probably 5 years old doing it with parental help. We know we have people well into their 90s still participating. If we looked at the most common age range, it would be between the ages of 45 and 75, or families with school-age children. There's a couple of different bumps on the curve. And rural, in terms of concentration, we have less volunteers in rural areas, but more per capita because people in rural areas certainly appreciate the importance of precipitation. But education-wise, we have folks that have never finished high school right up to PhDs.
So as far as time, how much time would you say it takes? Let's walk through what happens. So you have a precipitation event of some kind overnight. And I know for me, I like to do this before I go into work. So I'll walk out to the gauge, try to do it about the same time every morning, and look at how much moisture came down, empty the gauge. And then when I get to work, that's when I input the information. But I would say the most I've ever spent, if I wasn't looking around at the maps, because I love to look at the maps and see who got what, 5 minutes. It didn't take very long.
Yeah, I'd say 2 minutes if it was a zero day where nothing occurred, and people don't have to report zeros, but we love it when they do, especially if it's a day when showers are in the vicinity. And up to a few minutes, we'll have to say after you've had a big winter snow, it can take longer because not only are you doing encouraged to do a accumulation of new snow report, but also to get a water content of that snow, and that can take a little longer. But if it's just rainfall, it's 2 to 5 minutes is the kind of range that we anticipate.
And how many spotters do you have, and how active would you say that number is?
On any given day, and I'm going to give you, first of all, U.S.-wide statistics. I don't have the Utah ones mm-hmm. quite at my fingertips. But nationwide, on any given month, about 14,000 to 15,000 volunteers are reporting. On any given day, however, it's about 10,000 because not all of them choose to report their zeros, and some aren't always home. We don't, by no means do we expect people to have to be home all the time. We know people travel. We know they take vacations. And we tell people just either keep the gauge outside and report your accumulated total when you get back, or just don't worry about it. But the level of activity is thousands are reporting, and about two-thirds of them report very reliably. I know that in Utah, about 300 volunteers have signed up. On any given day, the number of reports are only maybe a third of that. So we wish we could encourage more activity there in Utah.
Okay, Utahns, we need to sign up and get more reports done.
Indeed.
And I need to do better in the winter because I'm one of those that tends to slack off from December through the end of February.
And it is a tougher measurement, and it's dark and cold, and I'm amazed that we get as many reports as we do. We probably have a 20% of our volunteers choose to take midwinter off, and we actually encourage that, especially for folks who may be older and maybe not as steady on their feet as they used to be, because slipping and sliding at 7 o'clock in the morning is not something we want to impose on people unless they flat out love it. But we certainly appreciate those that do, because winter precipitation variations are a little bit different in nature, more driven by topography, elevation, et cetera, than summer. But either way, it's moisture that matters. We all live in places where the rain affects our lives one way or another.
You know, it would be interesting to have a spotter up at, are you familiar with Peter Sink or Middle Sink?
Yes, I've driven by.
One of my best friends is kind of started that project back in the 80s, and I was thinking the other day how fun it would be to actually have not only the temperature measurement but how much precipitation is coming down in a location like that. Do you have many people that live in the extremes that report?
We have in Colorado, we have volunteers right up to 11,000 feet, almost up to tree line in a few places. In the Sierra, we have some. Cascades, not as much. In the mountains of Montana, some, but not too much. The answer is we do have some, but we wish we had more.
Well, how many have you ever had report in one day? What's the record? I know that you've had certain contests to get as many people to report as possible.
We passed the 12,000 reports in a given day for the first time just this last fall, and it was in context with the super big heavy rains and floods that we had here in Colorado. We had close to 1,200 Coloradans reporting.
Wow.
It was the first time we'd ever had over 1,000 Coloradans reporting, and we shot right past that and got up to 1,200. So it convinced me right away that a lot of people who had signed up really had their gauge and hadn't gotten around to reporting until a really big storm came, and then they figured out how to do it. And that was just a gold mine of information. For us, it made all the efforts that we have done since our 97 flash flood all came into fruition when so many people reported when we had a disastrous flood here recently, and we were able to do excellent mapping of that storm within hours instead of within months of when the storm occurred. It was fantastic.
Well, you're listening to the Zesty Garden, and I'm talking with Nolan Duskin, who's the state climatologist for the state of Colorado. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or you can send an email, questions, zestygarden@gmail.com. So, Nolan, tell me, who uses COCORAS as far as the information?
Well, state climatologists do. Our jobs are to monitor the climate of our respective states, and we're all very much in need of more detailed local precipitation data. So our whole myriad of state climatologists across the country are one set of users. National Weather Service is probably our largest set of users as of all. They're integrating the data automatically every single day in various products and services. We have the U.S. Department of Agriculture utilizes the data help to track drought areas as well as heavy rain and hail affected areas. We have mosquito control organizations in various parts of the country who are routine users of the data as they identify areas where rain has fallen that might have been sufficient to pond up. Again, this is mostly during the critical and sometimes the West Nile season, which would be later summer. And this is just a few of the groups that use engineers, consultants, parks and recreation, skiers, snowmobilers, fishermen. We have a group who posts COCORAS data on a fishing website because fishermen know that rainfall that may change the clarity of water and the temperature profile of water. It's just amazing to see some of the applications. But I tell you what, we have more master gardeners and master naturalists across the country who are not necessarily users of the data from the country as a whole, but who are actively involved in COCORAS because they themselves want to know what's going on in their own gardens and their own communities.
Well, we have a caller. We have Tom Harrodin from Castle Valley. Hi, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, guys. How are you today?
Doing great. What's your question or comment?
Well, I just wanted to comment. I've been a COCORAS observer for little more than 4 years now, and it is fun to to pay a little closer attention to the weather and see how much precip we're getting. But there are some other really valuable things that I kind of enjoy, and that's the citizen science aspect of it. It's the long-term observation that turns out being so valuable in the end. It's like the Christmas bird count, you know, after you've been doing it for dozens and dozens and 100 years all over the country at the same time, the data is a lot more meaningful.
That's for sure from our point of view, and the fact that we can pull up the data from any individual station or a county or a state or the country, and we can do it back to the beginning of the observations. Right now we have almost 5 years of data for the entire country, which is, again, I would have never dreamed that this would have been possible, and when we add up the 2 to 5 minute a day contribution from all these volunteers, it's a huge effort. If we were counting on our taxes to pay for this same services for the country, it would be a very expensive endeavor. This is a pretty neat way to go about it.
Great. Tom, thanks for calling in.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
So much.
Thank you, guys.
Chiming in. Appreciate it.
Well, we've just about reached the end of our time. I've been talking with Nolan Duskin, who is the state climatologist for Colorado, and it's the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network, otherwise known as CoCoRoS. And it is a great opportunity for all citizens to be able to measure rainfall events, snowfall events, any kind of moisture that falls from the skies. And if you want to participate, go to the Utah Public Radio website. It's upr.org, and click on programs and go to Zesty Garden, and you'll have the link right there. Nolan, thanks so much for joining me today on the Zesty Garden.
It was my pleasure.
And coming up next, we'll find out about how CoCoRoS works on the local level. So stay tuned. You're listening to The Zesty Garden on Utah Public Radio. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and I'm talking with Rob Davies, associate of the Utah Climate Center here at Utah State University, and we're discussing the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network, also known as CoCoRoS. Now, I have to disclose, I am a CoCoRoS observer. I have a rain gauge officially bought from the Utah Climate Center in my backyard, and I dutifully go out and record the amount of precipitation that comes into my yard, and then I go online and enter that. Why is that so important?
Well, first of all, let me say, Brian, you do indeed dutifully do that. We look at your measurements.
Now, I don't do it so well in the winter. I will admit
right.
That.
That name, snappy as it is, CoCoRoS, we have actually sort of, is a national organization, and we are the sort of the Utah chapter of it. And we've actually sort of renamed it here at the Utah Climate Center. We call it the Utah Water Rangers, rather than having to explain CoCoRoS to everybody. But yes, that's the official name. So why is that important? It turns out that precipitation is a meteorological event that is not like temperature. So temperature, you know, if it's 80 degrees down in Salt Lake and 70 degrees up here in Logan, you can pretty much figure it's somewhere in between the two temperatures in between Logan and Salt Lake, but precipitation doesn't work that way. And to try to get an accurate accounting of all the water that falls in the state, the denser the network of observations you have, the much better it is. And so certainly the National Weather Service has observing stations all across the state, but they're not that dense. And so if the more we have, the better. And if it's two neighbors right next to each other, that is, it's nice. But if one neighbor can't report, then maybe another one does, so we don't miss an observation in that neighborhood that particular day. But even if they do both report, it's nice to have a good check on one on the other. And you know, you don't have to live too far apart from someone to get significantly different amounts of precipitation from the same storm, particularly if it's a thunderstorm or something where it can, you know, just dump 3 inches of rain in Mendon and almost nothing here in Logan.
I've noticed that there's a spotter in Smithfield and one in North Logan, and I'm right in the middle, and our amounts can really vary. They really do. I mean, it just in one storm, it could be higher in Smithfield, and then it drops to mine and then lower in Logan. Or the reverse, or even I'll have a high amount and the guy right next to me doesn't.
Right, and that's the way precipitation works. I should say that there are actually a number of reasons to do this. And the original impetus was for getting much finer resolution measurements on heavy precipitation storms, thunderstorms that can potentially cause flooding. And it helps to have that information as soon as you can have it to get a much better sense of how intense the storm is and therefore be able to predict flooding and particularly flash flooding faster. Here in Utah, you know, and even if you're in a place where you're not so worried about that kind of a problem, it's also nice from a climatological standpoint and a hydrological standpoint to have as accurate an accounting of how much water is falling in your city or your county or even your state as possible. And like you just said, you can get wildly varying amounts from different people not so far apart. And so the denser network the denser the network of observers, the more accurate you're going to be able to account for every drop that falls. And here in Utah, of course, that's probably the primary reason for the network, is to try to get as good a handle, an accurate handle as we can on how much water is falling.
So as you've looked at the information, has anything jumped out at you?
One thing you can do is each observer gets at the end of the year what's called a water year report. So that runs from October 1st through September 31st of each year. So it's nice to just see for each community, get a sense of the different observers and how much water they're recording over the course of an entire year, that's for sure. I don't know that anything spectacular has ever jumped out at me at the data here in Utah. It's always fun to look at, and just you report it, and you can go in immediately, look at it on the map, and see what other people are reporting. I've seen some real dramatic examples in other places, and in particular, the very heavy rainfall events a couple of years ago in Tennessee, Nashville in particular, had a very dense network of Coco Ross observers. And if you looked at the observations that the National Weather Service had, it showed sort of a definitely very intense thunderstorm cell that was dropping this. But the dense network of Coco Ross observers were able to resolve the shape of that cell much better, and you actually found that it was two separate cells with two very intense centers of precipitation. And sort of scientifically, it's much more interesting to look at, and you get a better sense of the dynamics of what's happening inside a single large thunderstorm cell as well. That's always quite dramatic to look at.
Do we have enough spotters?
Here in Utah, no. We, by far, overall, we've got about 130 active observers. Now, not every observer reports every day. We'd like them to, but you go on vacation, or sometimes you might just forget or not be able to do it. So we get about 80 or so daily reports. But for a state the size of Utah, as you can imagine, it's just very sparse coverage. And in fact, most of our observers, we've got about 65 observers in Salt Lake County. So we need observers in other places.
So the rest of the other 15 of us are reporting for the whole state?
Well, not all of those 65 are active, but by far the most observers we have are in Salt Lake. But and then after that, as you might expect, Cache County has about 20 or so observers, and Utah County 20, and Weber County roughly 20 as well. But you get out to these, to the less populated counties, and we do have active observers in all counties, but quite a number of them just have one observer. So Carbon County, Daggett County, Emory, Juab, Kane, Wayne, Sevier County, Rich, and Paiute all only just have one active observer, and we could sure use more.
So when you've got a county like Wayne County, if you've got someone in Hanksville and there's only one person for the whole county, that's a long county. And so you get all the way over to Loa and Bicknell, there's no information.
That's right. Well, there's no information from Coco Ross. And
yes.
There are some additional stations from, different weather networks. But not that many. And I should say it's interesting, Coco Ross observers have become a huge resource for the National Weather Service and for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, for the Department of Agriculture, who use the data for drought assessment, and they use the data for water year reporting every year. We've got such a dense network of observers. And I don't know if maybe just issuing the challenge and appealing to people's pride, but South Dakota has a third of our population or less, and they've got about six times as many observers in South Dakota as we do. So if they can do it, I think we should be able to.
Why is that?
Well, part of it, actually it's a lot of advertising. It, we find that every couple of years we do a recruiting push and we get a spike. And South Dakota in particular has had just a very active state climatologist who's been really aggressively recruiting observers, done a very good job with that, and perhaps better than we've been able to do in the Utah Climate Center. But it's also not quite a fair comparison. A state like South Dakota doesn't have these large swaths of land that people really can't live in like we do here in Utah. And so the population, while not evenly distributed in South Dakota, is much more evenly distributed.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Rob Davies is an associate of the Utah Climate Center, and we're talking about the Coco Ross program, or the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. And so do a recruiting pitch. Who's the average person and who do you need?
Well, you know, this is fun. It's really it falls in a broader category that we often call citizen science. And this is where the average citizen can actually make an active and valuable contribution to important science. And it's very easy. You know, you purchase a rain gauge. And in fact, unfortunately, we just sold our last one, but on the website.
Guess who you sold it to? Me. I bought it and gave it to my friend out in Trenton. So
we've depleted our stock, but there are a couple of other companies on the website you can buy from. But that's all it is about a $25 rain gauge. And then you need to spend just a little time picking the right place on your property to put it. It needs to be, you know, out from underneath trees and not too close to the house and that sort of thing. And then just a little bit of time watching some videos we have online to teach you how to make precipitation measurements, both rain and snow. And it's you know, it's easy and it's an actual real contribution. And I think a lot of people who get started or maybe just a little bit not quite sure they want to do it, but their husband or their wife or their dad or something got it, signed them up for Christmas or something, and really get into looking at the data, having a full record of the precipitation that falls at your home throughout the year, and it can actually be quite fun.
So how does someone get signed up? I'll have a link on our website, so if you go to upr.org and want to have some more information, click on Programs and then go to Zesty Garden. I'll have information there. But if someone wanted to contact you directly or wanted to pick up, place an order for one of the rain gauges, how do they go about doing that?
Right. You can go to our website at the Utah Climate Center. I could give you the website, but it's easier just to Google Utah Climate Center and then follow your nose. When you get there, you will find on our main page a link to go to Coco Ross or the Utah Water Rangers. And just follow that, and you'll be kind of directed on how to sign up. It's very easy. You have to fill out a form, and you do have to give the location of your home. That's so we can very accurately locate you, because the data isn't valuable to us unless we know exactly where it's coming from. But overall, we leave you alone. We don't pester you very much.
Great. Well, I highly recommend anyone who has any interest, since I do this myself, to sign up for the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. And you can go to the Utah Climate Center or go to upr.org, and we'll have links to the program. Rob, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Rob Davies is an associate of the Utah Climate Center. Coming up next is Helen Cannon and Petals and Prose.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and still with spring fever. The passion that gardeners have for plants is sometimes hard to see and understand. It's like people who don't have pets really don't understand how someone can love a dog or a cat. Well, you might wonder how Colette, the French writer, how her mother Cito could turn down a chance to see her daughter just to see a plant bloom. But those of us who love plants will understand perfectly. This is a letter from Cito to one of Colette's husbands. Sir, you asked me to come and spend a week with you, which means I would be near my daughter, whom I adore. You who live with her know how rarely I see her, how much her presence delights me, and I am touched that you should ask me to come and see her. All the same, I'm not going to accept your kind invitation. At the time being, anyway. The reason is that my pink cactus is probably going to flower. It's a very rare plant I've been given, and I'm told that in our climate, it flowers only once every 4 years. Now, I'm already a very old woman, and if I went away when my pink cactus is about to flower, I am certain I shouldn't see it flower again. So I beg you, sir, to accept my sincere thanks and my regrets together with my kind regards. This note, signed Citronée Colette, was written by my mother to one of my husbands, the second. A year later, she died at the age of 77. Whenever I feel myself inferior to everyone about me, threatened by my own mediocrity, frightened by the discovery that a muscle is using its strength, a desire, its power, or a pain, the keen edge of its bite, I can still hold up my head and say to myself, I am the daughter of the woman who wrote that letter. That letter and so many more that I've kept, this one tells me in 10 lines that at the age of 76 she was planning journeys and undertaking them, but that waiting for the possible bursting into bloom of a tropical flower held everything up and silenced even her heart made for love. I am the daughter of a woman who in a mean, close-fisted, confined little place opened her village home to stray cats, tramps, and pregnant servant girls. I am the daughter of a woman who many a time, when she was in despair at not having enough money for others, ran through the wind-whipped snow to cry out from door to door at the houses of the rich that a child had just been born in a poverty-stricken home to parents whose feeble, empty hands had no swaddling clothes for it. Let me not forget that I am the daughter of a woman who bent her head, trembling between the blades of a cactus, her wrinkled face full of ecstasy over the promise of a flower, a woman who herself never ceased to flower untiringly during 3/4 of a century. Well, that wasn't a spring flower, but it is the same passion as those of us who wait to see the first snowdrop or the first daffodil or narcissus or hyacinth. This is an essay that I've liked for a long time by Carol Amon called Hyacinths to Feed the Soul. When I was a student nurse, I babysat during off hours to help pay my way. One day I got a call to sit for a whole weekend. All I knew when I headed for the job was that the couple wanted to get away from their 2 kids for a few days. Expecting that only rich people would be able to do that, I was surprised when the address turned out to be a tiny house in the borderline part of the city. Ted, the husband, had just joined an architectural firm. His wife, Ardith, looked terribly tired. They waited, obviously anxious to be off, while I got acquainted with the children, 2.5 years and 11 months old. I held the baby against my shoulder while Ted gave me the name of their hotel. "You'll be there the whole time?" I asked. "That's headquarters," Ted answered. "We'll sleep late and prowl around town. And when we get hungry, we'll eat and visit the art galleries." Mentally, I added up the cost of all that, plus my fee. "But won't that be terribly expensive?" I blurted. I had adopted them already. "Why, yes, I guess it will," Ted said, "but it's important." We're both tired and snapping at each other. "Ardith especially needs to get away from the children." Ardith smiled at me. "Don't you know about hyacinths to feed the soul?" She took a volume from the bookcase and opened it at a poem called Gulistan by a sheikh who lived more than 700 years ago. "If of thy mortal goods thou art bereft, and from thy slender store 2 loaves alone to thee are left, sell one and with the dull buy hyacinths to feed the soul." That poem taught me a good deal. These two didn't have enough money for the trip, but they were tuned in on a set of values I'd never even thought of. Sunday night when they came back, they looked like teenagers who'd just discovered love, and my money was tucked under a ribbon on a pot holding a lavender hyacinth. Over the years since, I've made a hobby of noticing people and whether or not they know about using non-essentials and extravagances occasionally to feed the soul. The happiest people do. A church organist I know grew up on a farm during the Depression. They didn't starve, but her childhood was not happy. Then when I was in 7th grade, things changed, she told me. My folks bought a secondhand piano and arranged with a music teacher in town to accept vegetables in payment for my lessons. The neighbors called it a useless extravagance. The miracle is that my folks knew what was important. 20 cashmere sweaters couldn't have charged me with the confidence that piano gave me. And a no-nonsense mother I know lets Christmas and family birthdays release her usual tight lid on frivolity. "When I was a child," she explains, "gifts were always dirty shoes, warm gloves, underwear. After I got married, I decided that we'd somehow manage the essentials and that the special occasions would be for fun. Now my husband and I give each other and the kids wild things we'd never dare include in the budget." Her idea of zingy gifts: tickets to a far-out play, a white velvet coat she's worn twice and has had cleaned twice, but which makes her feel positively elegant. For the children, redeemable coupons for gooey treats at the ice cream store. Flowers given on birthdays or other predictable occasions are hardly hyacinths. But when bouquets are offered to celebrate Monday or the anniversary of the day we got the car paid for, or simply, thank you for putting up with me for so long, what a different matter. To send a relative a card on his birthday is not unusual, but to pop a note into the mail apropos of nothing is a hyacinth. The mother who spells I love you with chocolate chips on the top of a no occasion cake is proclaiming loud and clear that she cares. When our stomachs are empty, we get hungry. Symptoms of soul starvation are subtler. Tomorrows and tomorrows are rolling by. Paychecks are being spent on bread and shoes and rent, while the walls of our souls remain bare. If this matters to us, we can do something. We can buy hyacinths to feed the soul. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. Thank you for listening.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. This is KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL Richfield, KUSK Vernal, KUSR Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.